So the exam, I would say, was pretty average. I don't know if you know about cumulative fraction distributions, but that's kind of a class distribution. It's kind of all the grades. People got pretty much all the possible grades from pretty good to pretty bad. And the average grade was roughly 38. The way I grade things is I set the high score, which was 58, equal to 100. And typically that ends up putting the median grade in the BC range, and that was the case this time. So if you have particular questions, I'll maybe answer them, but generally speaking, I think it's better to spend the class period on the new material. I'll scan the problem answers. Already, if you were to go online, you would find screencast answers to the exam questions, just like there was for the 191 was. Same place, go to the home page, click on MP4, and they are all there currently under the name 105, T1, 12, and then MC for the multiple choice ones and P for the problem ones. Particular questions. So again, the way it works, if you read that handout sheet, in a purple box, you'll find your raw score, and you can check to see that I added right, equals your renormalized score, so that's the score that counts, the one that's from 0 to 100, and then equals a letter grade. So it's the renormalized score that I put in the grade book. It's basically the only thing that matters. And then in a green area over to the lower right-hand side, you'll find the total of your quiz and homework score. So that's WebAssign plus what we did quizzes in class as a fraction of the high score in the exam in the class. So once again, I'll set the 143 equal to 100 so you can see what fraction you are of the quiz and homework stuff. I don't know, maybe a third of you have bonus points, which you'll see as plus 7 or something like that in the numerator of your green homework score. So that was for what we did before the exam. So remember, you did those hard copy problems and the eye quizzes. So the ones that were picked out as correct answers to the problems are the ones that got bonus points. And those things are also scanned and online if you wanted to check those out. So let's see if what I said is true, right? Sometimes I accidentally lie. I claim this works, but boy, I don't claim it strongly. Did that thing click or not? So I claim if you go to the, and I haven't checked it, so I'm not 100% sure. I guess I kind of turned off the wrong set of lights. No, this one. So if you go to kind of the usual, so this is the kind of physics webpage, go to the 105, go to MP4, and then here, let's see. So right there are the multiple choice questions, supposedly, access forbidden. So I haven't gotten it right yet. Looks like I should have. Why didn't that take? Maybe I need to put another. Okay, so this time for sure. Yeah, so it would allow me to download this to your favorite video player. And it's the, you can hear me talking and giving the answers in the back. Okay, so class webpage, MP4. These are the file names that have your stuff. I can't figure out which knob is which. Other questions? Yes?
Can we go over the multiple choice methods?
So why don't I go over the ones that were frequently missed? So the ones that gave people problems were all of them from about halfway through. People mostly got things until about number 7. So if you look at, so first of all, the X's show you where, on your thing, should show you where I think the right answers are, if I hit them right. So if you look carefully at that sketch, you'll notice that before and after here, in the X direction, the dot is always going forward 2 clicks, two little grid points. So it has a constant X velocity. Before here, it was going down. After here, it was going up. So right at here, the velocity is 0, but increasing. And therefore, in terms of part 4, there has to be an acceleration, right? If the y velocity is changing, there's acceleration in the upward direction. The x velocity seems to be a constant, so there's no x acceleration. So the only one that's wrong is D. So I believe it is true that no one in this class got 8 correct. So you remember Newton's first law says that if the sum of the forces are 0, you have a constant velocity. So when the tension becomes equal to the weight, you continue to slide at a constant speed. So none of the above. Question?
Can you do number 6?
So to add them up, B is the right answer. Right, you put them tip to tail, and if you just look at the vector, the more they are aligned, which is in case B, the bigger they're going to be. So Newton's third law, in terms of number 9, Newton's third law says that if object A puts a force on object B puts an equal and opposite force on object A. So the force of the pebble on the window, it's identical. The force of the brick on the window, it's identical. So none of the above. If we are deaccelerating, the force, right, so the whole truck and the crate are slowing down, so the only force is going to be the frictional force, and it has to be pushing towards the rear of the truck. If we look at the kind of Rupert problem, a component of tension has to, so there's no acceleration, so the forces have to balance. So this piece of tension has to equal the frictional force, which requires the tension in total to be more than the frictional force. And this thing is partially lifting it. So the normal force doesn't have to lift the entire weight of the object. So the normal force is going to be less than the weight. Some of the forces have to be 0 because the velocity is constant. So if you throw something straight up, there are no strings attached, no springs attached. The only contact is with the air, and we're told to neglect air forces. So on our list of forces, the only remaining force is gravity, and gravity is the same. So there's only one force. It's the force of gravity, and it's constant, and it's downward, so D. More questions? Laura, huh?
Yes.
Thank you.
Bob?
Josh.
Josh. Oh, must be the one I had in my hand. Other questions? So the screencasts are there. There'll be, as I say, a scan of the problem solutions. And it'll be good to review, of course, for the final. A lot of these questions will occur again.
Any kind of test corrections, should I actually cut it?
No. Nope. Yep, so there's no, what's written in stone is written in stone, I think.
Back to the problem. I have this question, because you say that the crate remains in the same spot as you're looking for is van. If an object isn't moving, doesn't that mean that the net force on that object is zero?
But moving compared to what? It's not moving according to the bottom of the van, but the van is moving.
Well, the van's moving, but then as it's breaking, the crate doesn't move.
Relative to the relative, it stays in the same spot on the van.
Right. I mean, it stays in the same spot in the van, but even as it's decelerating, it's not like it's sliding forward. So.
Correct. But it's deaccelerating, right? It was going 60 miles an hour, and now it's stopped.
So with this, we're going to be comparing it to the van and not just everything in general.
So if you're going to apply Newton's law, you have to be in what's called an inertial frame, not an accelerating frame. Right, but you know the thing deaccelerated, right? In fact, we did this thing as an iQuiz. More questions? So lots of these questions were online. If you checked out the old exams, I think the spider problem was online also. Question? Okay. So the topic for today is energy, work and energy. And these are probably the most important concepts that we're going to be covering in this class. And maybe surprisingly, they weren't really understood by Newton. So an understanding of work and energy probably comes around in the mid-1800s, and it would be hard even to say who discovered these concepts. They kind of came about over time. So the work is equal to the force times the displacement. That's in the case of where we have something that's moving in a straight line. So if I push this thing forward, I have to be doing work on it. And I can calculate that work by just this product. If we have things that are angled, if we have a two-dimensional problem, so let's say we have a force that is in that direction and a displacement that is in that direction, then what we have to do is take the magnitude of the force times the magnitude of the displacement times the cosine of the angle between them. And one way of thinking about this is that the only thing that actually does work is the piece of the force that's in the direction of the displacement. The piece of the force that is perpendicular to the displacement doesn't do any work at all. And that sounds, I don't know, a little bit funny, right? Because if I pick up this brick and I carry it, boy, it sure seems like I'm doing work, right? If I lift it, seems like it's doing work too, but just holding it seems to be requiring doing work. But if we look at this sort of situation, I think you can guess that no one's paying for gas to keep that thing going. So apparently something can move forever in a straight line and not require anything to actually power it. Okay, so there are forces that are active on this guy, right? There's a normal force and there's a force of gravity, but they're not actually doing any work on the project. Okay, so work has a somewhat funny definition that doesn't exactly line up with what you're used to. So only thing that counts are when forces are aligned with displacements. Then we have work. And of course, we'll have negative work if we have forces that are unaligned with displacement, because the cosine of the angle will be negative.
So that second one there is for 2D?
Yes. Yep. So anytime we have forces and displacements that aren't exactly aligned, then we have to put in this cosine factor. And since the cosine of 90 degrees is zero, if the force is perpendicular to the displacement, no work is going to be done. So why invent kind of a new topic? Well, it turns out that the work allows you to calculate the change in the kinetic energy. It is always true that the net work, the work done by all of the forces, is equal to the change in the kinetic energy. So what's kinetic energy? Well, the kinetic energy has a very simple formula. It's just 1/2 the mass times the speed squared. For some forces, and the forces that this is true of are called conservative forces, we can write the work done by that force in a particularly simple form. It's just minus the change in some quantity, and we call that quantity the potential energy. So the list of conservative forces includes all of the common forces. So it's going to include gravity, it's going to include electricity and magnetism, it includes the weak force and the strong force, but it doesn't include friction. Friction is probably the primary example of something that is not a conservative force. So if we look at the work done for a general case, we can break it up in the work done by the conservative forces and the work done by the non-conservative forces like friction, and that has to equal the change in the kinetic energy. If we plug in that the work done by the conservative forces is minus the change in the potential energy, then we've got the equation that the work done by the non-conservative forces is the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy. And it's really in order to get a plus sign here that we choose to have a minus sign there. And we can put this together and say then that the work by the non-conservative forces is the change in the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, and those things combined are going to be the energy. Sometimes the mechanical energy. If there isn't friction present, so if the work done by the non-conservative forces is zero, then we have the statement that the energy is constant. There's zero change in it. And that goes under the fancy name conservation of energy. So there are kind of three great conservation laws that we're going to be talking about. In this chapter, we're talking about conservation of energy. In the next chapter, we're going to be talking about conservation of linear momentum. And I think in the chapter after that, we're going to be talking about conservation of angular momentum. Okay, but of all of these, by far the most important is the idea of conservation of energy. And I'm sure you've run into this lots of times in your chemistry classes when you're adding up heats of formation, you're talking about bond energies. What's behind all of that is conservation of energy. So for us currently, the only conservative force is going to be gravity. And that seems like such a small fraction of our list, kind of why bother? But in fact, it kind of is the whole list. That is to say, really all forces are fundamentally conservative, and it's really just the unimportant case of friction that's not conservative. There's kind of a special case that's maybe worth talking about, and that's the normal force that's on our list of forces. Typically, the normal force won't be doing any work. If we think about something that's sliding down an inclined plane, the normal force is pushing this way, and of course, the displacement is that way and they're perpendicular, So the normal force won't be doing any work under those circumstances. But you can't make that statement in general. If you have a box that's in an elevator, then the normal force is pushing up and the displacement is up, so then the normal force did do some work. Frequently, but not always, the normal force is also not going to do any work. So mostly the non-conservative forces we're going to be talking about are going to be the friction force. So the other thing that's on our list of forces is the spring force, and we'll come to that Monday. We'll talk about the spring force. It's also a conservative force. Other questions? Okay, so the work kinetic energy theorem. You know, it gets a star bigger than the star that you have for Newton's second law, which seemed to be pretty important last time. And this version of it, that the work done by the non-conservative forces, that also gets a star that's bigger than Newton's second law. So we're going to be making lots of use of those equations in the rest of this course. Okay, so let's see how we're going to use those things. So here's kind of a lineup of problems to take a look at. Oh, we're back to this. Okay. Well, let's actually start with 18 and then come back to 15. So what we have here is a guy who's pushing a crate and comes to some rough ground, and now there's going to be a frictional force, and we're supposed to calculate lots of things like the work done by all of the different forces that are involved. He's going to be pushing with a constant force that is 275 newtons. And since that force is in the direction of the displacement, he's certainly going to be doing positive work. The frictional force is going to be fighting him. The frictional force is in the opposite direction of the displacement, so that's going to be negative work. And as we've said is often the case, the normal force isn't going to be doing any work because the normal force is going to be perpendicular to the displacement. So we know that the work done by all of these forces has to add up to the change in the kinetic energy. We're told what the initial velocity was and what the mass is, so we can calculate the initial kinetic energy. And so we can add up all of these works to figure out what the final kinetic energy. And if we know the final kinetic energy, we'll be able to calculate the speed. Okay? So in doing all of this, we really don't have to apply F equals ma anyplace. But I think for practice, as much as anything else, they wanted us to calculate the net force. So here's our crate, and we're told that it weighs 92 kilograms, and therefore it has a weight and a responding normal force. We have a force that is 275 newtons that's pulling this way. This is kinetic friction, and we have a formula for kinetic friction. It's equal to the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. And we know that there's no acceleration in the y direction, so the normal force is just going to equal to the weight. So this frictional force we can calculate as the kinetic coefficient of friction times the mass times g. And they tell us this kinetic coefficient of friction is 0.358. And of course, we know the mass is 92, and we know that g is 9.8. So we can crank all of that out on our calculators. And what we're going to find is it's bigger than the pushing force. So this thing is actually going to slow down as a result. So this is 322.8 newtons. So the net force is the plus 275 minus that that frictional force. So the work done on the crate while it is on the rough surface. So under those circumstances, the displacement, and we're told that the displacement is this 0.65 meters, is in the opposite direction of the force. So the work done by friction is going to be minus the magnitude of the frictional force times the distance it's gone. So that's minus this 322.8 newtons times the displacement of 0.65 meters. So I get 209.8, and my unit is going to be newton meters. But energy is so important, it's going to occur frequently, that just as we've bothered to name a kilogram meter per second squared for a famous dead physicist, we're going to name a newton meter for a famous dead physicist, namely Joule. So minus 209 joules is the work done by the frictional force. The work done by pushing, in that case, the force is in the direction of the displacement, so it's going to be a positive work, and it's going to be 275 times 0.65. So it's going to be plus 178.8 joules. So the net work, just to add these guys together, net or total work, take your choice, is going to be negative. And I get minus 31.05 joules. And that net work has to be the change in the kinetic energy. So that's going to be the final kinetic energy minus the initial kinetic energy. So the final kinetic energy I can calculate by putting the initial kinetic energy on the other side of the equation. So I've got the initial kinetic energy minus this 31 joules is equal to the final kinetic energy. And the final kinetic energy is, of course, equal to 1/2 the mass times the speed squared. So once I've calculated that, I should be able to calculate the final speed. So the initial kinetic energy, we can calculate 1/2 the mass times the speed squared. They told us the mass was 92 kilograms, and they told us that the initial speed was 0.85 meters per second. So I've got 92, half of that, 0.85 squared times all that. And I've got 33.2 joules. Oh, let's take a look at the units. So the real units are going to be kilogram meters squared per second squared. And if we borrow one of those meters, that's going to be a kilogram meter per second squared times a meter. And that combination, I hope you remember, is a newton. And a newton meter is a joule. So, yep, we are getting units of energy from this kinetic energy calculation.
Are we supposed to add the
31
joules?
Not, so, we're adding the work, but the work is negative. So effectively, we're subtracting it. So the net work was minus 31 joules. So when we bring the initial kinetic energy to the other side, we're actually adding the net work to the initial kinetic energy. So I'm plugging it in here, right, for this initial kinetic energy. You're not happy.
So the initial kinetic energy is equal to the net work.
No.
Okay, so that's what we're trying to find is where the
So we're trying to find the final kinetic energy. The kinetic energy theorem says the net work is the change in the kinetic energy. Change is final minus initial. So I can bring the initial to the other side of the equation. And I then have the initial kinetic energy plus this negative work is equal to the final kinetic energy. You got all that? So that's what we have. So we're going to have this 33.2 joules minus this number here, which was 31 joules. That's equal to the final kinetic energy.
Okay.
So it may look like subtraction, but it's actually addition. So what we get here then is 2.18 joules is the final kinetic energy, which is 1/2 the mass times the final velocity squared. So if we just rearrange this guy, the final velocity is going to be twice this 2.18 joules divided by the 92 kilograms square rooted. Let's check our units. So under the square root, we have kilogram, we have joules per kilogram. And we know a joule is a kilogram meter squared per second squared. So the kilograms cancel out, and under the square root, we have meters squared per second squared, so we're going to get our answer in meters per second. Okay, so multiply that by 2 and divide it by 92, take the square root. And the answer that I get is 0.218 meters per second. Okay, so the work done by all of the forces added up, and you're going to get the change in the kinetic energy. The guy is doing positive work, friction is doing negative work, and in fact, there's more negative work being done than positive work. So there's going to be a decrease in the kinetic energy. And since there's a decrease in the kinetic energy, there's a decrease in the velocity. Questions? Okay, so let's go back and take a look at 15. So we could have worked 15 just fine without using energy concepts, using the stuff that we had back in chapter 2, because this is all a one-dimensional motion problem. We have a bullet that is initially going at 575 meters a second, and it's going to run into a piece of wood, and it's going to come to a stop after traveling 5.5 centimeters. And of course, the only reason it slowed down was because there is a big frictional force that is applied to it as it is moving through the wood. And we're supposed to calculate that frictional force. Okay, and we're supposed to do this using work and energy. As I say, we could do the same problem just using the stuff we had in chapter 2. So the displacement is in the opposite direction of that unknown frictional force. So the work being done by that frictional force is minus the unknown value of the frictional force times the displacement, which we do know, 5.5 centimeters. And that has to equal the change in the kinetic energy, which is the final kinetic energy minus the initial kinetic energy. Finally, the thing is stopped. So there's no kinetic energy in the end state. In the initial state, we can calculate the kinetic energy. It's 1/2 the mass. They gave it to us in grams, so remember we want to convert it to kilograms. So 7.8 times 10 to the minus 3 kilograms times the speed squared. Six Same thing applies to the centimeters. We want to convert them to meters, so this is 0.055 meters. Notice that we've got minus signs on both sides of the equation, so we can kind of cancel those guys out. So we've got then that the frictional force is all of this stuff divided by delta x. So we've got 1/2 the mass times the speed squared all over the displacement, which is 0.055 meters. Let's check our units. So we have kilograms from the mass, we have meters squared per second squared from the velocity, and we're dividing this through by meters. And a kilogram meter per second squared is a newton, so we are going to get out newtons in the end. So if we crank through this thing, we've got 7.8 inner exponent minus 3. We're supposed to take half of that, and 575 squared times it and divide it by 0.055. And we get a force that is 2.34 times 10 to the fourth newtons. So I claimed that we could solve the same problem by chapter 2 methods. Let me just outline that. Remember that we know the initial speed and we know the final speed is 0. And we know the displacement, so we could get the acceleration. And we know that the only force present is this frictional force, so the sum of the forces is just that frictional force. All we need to do is to multiply it by the multiply the acceleration by the mass to get that force. And I'm not going to bother with part B because actually that is, again, just anytime we're dealing with time, we're not so much dealing with energy. We can solve part B just by using the usual stuff from chapter 2. So let's take a look at this ski jump problem. So we have a frictionless surface here on the ski jump, and that means that there's no frictional force to do negative work. So the only thing that's going to be present is the normal force, and the normal force isn't going to be doing any work because the motion is going to be perpendicular to the normal force, and the force of gravity. So the only force that's important in terms of work, the only one doing work is going to be the work of gravity. And you remember that gravity is a conservative force, and so the work done by gravity is minus the change in the potential energy. And I claim that at least near the surface of the Earth, the potential energy of gravity is just given by mg times the height. Okay, so the setup is we've got this ski jump, and the exit point is 10 meters high, and the initial point is 50 meters high. And first thing we're supposed to do is to figure the speed of the skier when he's just leaving the jump. We know that he started with zero speed, so the initial kinetic energy is zero. If we calculate the final kinetic energy, we'll be able to calculate the final speed because the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. And we have the work kinetic energy theorem. So the work done by gravity, that's minus the change in the potential energy, that has to equal the change in the kinetic energy. And the change is final minus initial. And we know the initial kinetic energy was zero. And it's not too hard to calculate the change in potential energy. It's just going to depend on the final height minus the initial height. Right, so we've got minus mg times the final height minus mg times the initial height. That's going to be equal to the final kinetic energy. I don't know, don't much like minus signs. Let's flip it around. So this is going to be mg times the initial height minus mg times the final height is equal to the final kinetic energy. And if we write down the formula for kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, notice that the masses are all going to cancel out, which is good because they didn't tell us the mass. This minus sign?
Yeah.
So I distributed it, right? So minus times minus became this plus, and this one became minus. So if I bring the two up, what I have is twice, and I can factor out the g, the initial height minus the final height is equal to the velocity squared. So the initial height was 50. The final height was 10, and we know that g is 9.8. So in order to calculate the final speed, all I need to do is 2 times 9.8 times 40. And I get pretty much exactly 28 meters per second. Question.
The mass gravity height initial minus mass gravity height final. Why did you set it then, or how did you know to set it to 1/2 mv squared?
Because that's what kinetic energy is, right? Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared.
Okay, so then the first part is just calculating the final part of the kinetic energy?
Yes, because the initial part was zero. Where's this thing from?
Yeah.
So that's the work done by gravity.
Okay, and how does that relate to the kinetic energy final?
Well, because we know that the work done by all of the forces gives you the change in the kinetic energy. That's the work kinetic energy theorem. In this case, the only forces that are present are gravity and the normal force. The normal force isn't doing any work. So the only thing we have for the net work is the work done by gravity.
Okay.
And we can calculate that just by the change in the potential energy of gravity. More questions? So, kind of a more common way of working this problem is to, instead of talking about the work kinetic energy theorem, to talk about conservation of energy, because there are no non-conservative forces. So if there are no non-conservative forces, the work done by the non-conservative forces is zero, so the change in the energy has to be zero. Which means I can say that the initial energy has to equal the final energy. And I can just write those things out. So in the initial situation, we have initial kinetic energy, but that's zero because it started from rest. And we have initial potential energy that just depends on the initial height. In the final situation, we have some final kinetic energy, and we have some final gravitational potential energy. So all we're saying is in the absence of, if all the forces are conservative, then energy is conserved and we can set the initial energy equal to the final energy. And what we've got then is exactly the same equation that we had before. Let me bring this term over to the side of the equation. So we have mgh initial minus mgh final is 1/2 mv final squared. So once again, the masses cancel out. We can bring the two up, and we have 2g times h initial minus h final is equal to the final velocity squared. Okay, so conservation of energy or the work energy kinetic theorem, they both work, no pun intended. Remember that the potential energy of gravity is just mgh. So the second part of this problem, this is just a projectile motion problem, right? Because we now know that this person is moving at 28 meters per second at an angle that is 45 degrees. And so we can, you know, be off to the races to calculate that trajectory. It doesn't really have anything to do with energy. So I'm not going to work the last parts of the problem. Those are just repeats of projectile motion. Questions? Let's do 85 first. Kind of 80 is maybe unnecessarily complicated. So here we have a truck that's going uphill at constant velocity. So constant velocity, we know lots of things immediately, right? No acceleration, no net force, no change in kinetic energy. It's going up at a 7-degree slope, and we've got a 50-kilogram package on the floor, and we're supposed to calculate lots of things, like what's the net work done on the package? What's the answer? Zero, right? Because there's no change in kinetic energy. The net work equals the change in kinetic energy. This thing is going the same speed at the beginning, at the end. So the net work has to be zero. What's the work done by gravity, the normal force, and frictional force? What's the work done by the normal force? Zero, right? Because the normal force is perpendicular to the surface. It unless the surface is moving, it's not going to be doing any work. And even in this case where the surface is moving, it's still not doing any work because the motion is perpendicular to the normal force. So we've got the work done by the force of gravity and the work done by the frictional force. And if we know either of those two, we know the other, because we know that the net work is zero. So this plus this has to add up to zero. And it's easy to calculate the work done by gravity. Right? The work done by gravity is minus the change in the potential energy, and the potential energy is just mgh. So we can calculate the work done by gravity immediately. Well, not exactly immediately. We have to do some trig. So the work done by gravity, or any conservative force, is minus the change in the potential energy. The potential energy of gravity is mgh. So this is minus mgh final minus mgh initial. And I at least don't like that minus sign, so I'm going to pull it through and factor out an mg. So I'm going to have h initial minus h final. Notice that we're going to get a negative number, right? Because the final height is certainly going to be more than the initial height. Does that make sense? Well, it went up, but gravity went down. So we're expecting to get a negative number for the work done by gravity. On the other hand, the frictional force is the thing that's carrying it upward. So we're expecting that the frictional force is going to do positive work, which is good because they're supposed to add up to zero. So one's going to be negative and one's supposed to be positive. Okay, so in order to calculate this change in height, we have to make the triangle. So we're told that this is 7 degrees, and we're told that this is 340 meters. So this change in height is just going to be 340 times the sine of 7 degrees. And again, notice that it went up. H final is more than H initial. So this is going to be minus mg times the hypotenuse, 340 times the sine of 7 degrees. So we know the mass, 50 kilograms. We know G, 9.8. So we know everything. We can crank this through. So we got the overall minus sign. We've got 50 kilograms, 9.8 meters per second, 340, and then the sine of 7 degrees. And what I get, put in the minus sign, minus 2.03 times 10 to the fourth. Let's check our units. We've got kilograms, we've got meters per second squared, and we've got meters. So what we've got is, this thing is a newton, so we've got newton meters, and newton meters are joules. So I had to put that in kind of by hand. So this is the fully correct answer here. And this asks for the initial height minus the final height. And we can see that the final height is more than the initial height. If you want, I could call the initial height 0 and the final height equal to that. And I could plug in this is 0 and then this is that. And then I'd get this minus sign. That's not actually how I thought about it, though. I just saw that it was going up, and so I kind of put in the minus sign, realizing that. More questions? Okay, so here we have kind of a convoluted problem where we're pushing something up the wall. And we know that there are lots of forces that are going to be present, right? We're pushing it with this force F, which is going to cause a normal force. The thing weighs something, so there's going to be a force of gravity, and friction is going to be fighting us all the way. And we're supposed to figure out the work done by lots of these things. But some of them are pretty easy off the bat. So what's the work done by the normal force? Zero, right? Because the normal force is pointing out from the surface and the displacement is up, so the normal force is doing zero work. I know 90% of the time the normal force isn't doing any work, but I can't say 100% of the time. What's the work done by the force of gravity? Well, the work done by the force of gravity is just minus the change in the potential energy, and they tell us that it was pushed 3 meters up. We're expecting a negative number, right? Because force of gravity is down and the displacement is up. Or if you like, the final height is more than the initial height, but the work done by gravity is just going to be minus mg times the 3 meters that it went up. And of course, it's just as easy to figure out the change in gravitational potential energy. That's just mgh. So, I don't know, what's kind of funny to me about this problem is all of the final parts, we didn't have to do a lot of work in order to find the answer to. But the thing they ask us to first is the one that's going to take most of the work. I mean, usually people arrange their questions so that the earlier parts have something to do with the final parts and maybe even are the easiest parts. Okay, so what's the work done by the force F? Well, what we need is they've kind of given us the wrong angle to do it immediately. So the displacement is vertically up, and they're telling us that this force is at that angle theta. So we really need this angle here if we're going to use the cosine of the angle. And I don't know, I'm happy. So we could use the cosine of 90 minus theta, but I'm kind of happier thinking about it this way. Let me break this force up into two components. This one is, of course, not going to do any work because it's perpendicular to the motion. This one here, I can calculate it's F times the sine of the angle. and the force and the displacement are in the same direction. So the work done by F is going to be F times sine of theta times the 3 meters that it went up. Okay, but that's not the answer. We actually have to calculate this force F. And to do that, we have to go back to all of the stuff we've been talking about from the previous chapter. So it's back to free body diagrams in order to figure out what's going on with F. So the key thing to recognize in order to calculate F is that there's no acceleration. Right? They've told us it in kind of a funny way by telling us that it's a constant speed. If the speed is constant, there's no acceleration. If there's no acceleration, then the net force is zero. So let's draw our free body diagram. So the normal force may look funny, but it's pushing that way. We've got our force F that is pushing this way. We've got a frictional force, which is fighting us. And we've got the force of gravity that is pointing down. And we know that the sum of the forces have to be zero. That's one factoid. And the other factoid we have is that the frictional force is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. Okay, so free body diagram, set up coordinate systems, choose your axes that align with as many things as possible. Well, 3 out of 4 things are aligned with the normal coordinate system, so I think that's the reasonable one to take. And things are kind of easier in the x direction, so let's do that one first. So if we break our force F into 2 pieces, we've got that. So this force that's in the positive x direction is F times the cosine of theta. And we have a normal force that's in the other direction, no acceleration. So we have F cosine theta minus n is equal to 0. In the vertical direction, there's only one force that's going up. It's this one here, this piece of F. So we have F times the sine of theta. It's fighting gravity, and it's fighting the frictional force. All of those things have to add up to 0. The frictional force is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. And from this equation, we can see that the normal force is just F times the cosine of theta. So if we put that in here, what we've got is F times the sine of theta minus mg minus mu k F cosine theta has to add up to 0. So now it's just a matter of solving for F. Right? So if we put this mg on the other side of the equation and factor out an F, we have F times the sine of theta minus mu k times cosine theta has to equal mg. And when we divide that through to get F, we get F is equal to mg all on top of that trigonometry. Okay, so we know everything. It's a 5 kilogram block. G is 9.8. The angle that we're pushing at was 30 degrees. The coefficient of kinetic friction is 0.3. And we've got cosine of 30 degrees. And we can crank that out. But do notice that this really doesn't have anything exactly to do with this chapter, right? They're just, I think, trying to remind us that we can't afford to forget all of the stuff we learned in the previous chapter. And I get 204 newtons. And once I've got that, then I can calculate the work done by F. Okay, so let's try some iQuiz questions. A little bit louder. So the work done by F is never in newtons. It better be in joules, so that can't be the right answer. Yeah, so once we've got that F, to get the actual work, we're going to do that. And notice the units that we're going to get are going to be newtons times meters, and those are joules. Okay, so we've got four different pucks that are moving on this frictionless table. They have masses that are 1, 2, 3, 4, and we're applying forces that are as shown. And we have different finish lines. Which puck has the largest kinetic energy when it crosses the finish line? See a mix of C's and D's. Pretty much a 50-50 mix of C's and D's. I think probably majority C's. So kinetic energy is kind of complicated to calculate, right? We'd need to take masses and velocities. So it seems like that's probably the wrong way to go, for an iQuiz question at least. But remember, we can calculate the change in kinetic energy by the work done. So which one has the most work? So the masses don't matter at all. The only thing that matters is work. And work is force times distance. So which one has big distances and big forces? So we're D, right? The biggest distance and the biggest force, both present in D. Gotta have the So we have two hockey pucks. A is the heavy one, B is the light one. They're both pushed by equal forces F. Which puck wins the race? So this is back to Newton's second law sorts of stuff. Which one has the bigger acceleration? Bigger acceleration? So the small mass is going to have the bigger acceleration, right? Because the acceleration is the force divided by the mass. So the low mass guy is going to accelerate more, and it's going to cross the puck first. Which one does more work? I claim this is a two-handed answer. No-handed answer. Everyone's saying A. So work is force times distance, right? It doesn't have anything to do with mass. So same force, same distance. You can either, I guess, hold up no card, or you could hold up both cards, because it's exactly the same. I guess no cards is the right answer, because neither does more work. Which puck has more kinetic energy when it crosses the finish line? So it's going to take a lot longer for A to cross the finish line than B, because it's got slower acceleration. But it's got more mass. So who's going to have the most kinetic energy? Once again, it's majority A's. I would claim this is a two-handed answer, right? The kinetic energy is the work that's done. Work doesn't depend on mass, it just depends on force and distance. So identical amounts of kinetic energy when they cross the finish line.
When we look at the formula you gave us for kinetic energy, doesn't that have mass?
Yeah, it does. So it looks like mass is going to be an important factor. But if we think about what's going to happen, clearly A is going to be going slower, right? Because it has less acceleration. But it's got more mass. So how does it win out? It's got more of one and less of the other, and we need to multiply them together. So it's not looking good, but we don't have to worry about it because the work that's done gives you the kinetic energy. Work is equal to the change in kinetic energy. And it must work out that those masses and velocities do exactly the same thing. One being bigger and one being smaller leads to exactly the same result because the same work is done. Okay, so quitting time, I guess.